From the beginning of time, men and women have tried to please God and do the right things, living the right way. Those who have done that, I should say, men and women who have tried to please God and do the right things, they stand out, don't they, as being different. They have been the recipient of derision and scorn, persecution, and even death. For trying to please God and trying to do the right things? That seems like a dichotomy or a contradiction to some, doesn't it? The very thought, of course, being that, well, if I obey God and I please Him, God will be pleased with me. God, therefore, will bless me. And since we are physical human beings, we assume that those blessings that we want to receive, we think of physical blessings. We think back of the blessings and cursings chapter. We think of being physically blessed in ways because we're doing the things that are pleasing to God. But God is much more concerned with the spiritual and with the eternal things and preparing us to enter into that world with Him, a spiritual and eternal world. So even though sometimes it may not look like we're receiving blessings as a result of our obedience and submission to God, in reality, we are. We are being blessed in different ways, in spiritual ways. The Bible talks frequently about the value of suffering, about the value of the trials that we go through in our lives, because these trials are helping to develop something in us. Righteous character, godly character. We're reminded in 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 7, and this is a scripture that we have quoted many times when we talk about trials. It says, so that the genuineness of your faith, that's what God is looking for. How genuine, how real are you in what you believe, in what you profess to believe, in what you claim to be, you know, as part of your life. That the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, so even gold will perish, it's physical, even though it's tested by fire, your faith may be found to praise, honor, and glory at a future time, not now. When is that time? At the revealing of Jesus Christ, at the second coming, at the sound of that seventh trumpet. Then our faith will be found, will have praise, honor, and glory in the faith and the character that we've built. So clearly, God is putting a very high value on faith. I talked about that recently, a high confidence in our faith and godly character. We base our lives on the Bible, the laws of God, the promises of God. In particular, when we think of something that we are hoping for and looking for, we think of our reward being eternal life. That seems like, you know, since Ponce de Leon, looking for the fountain of youth in Florida, you know, we want to live forever. And the prospect of actually having eternal life in the family of God, we hang our hat on that promise. The Bible is filled with examples of men and women who did the same thing. And we can study and learn from their examples. We can also see in the examples of men and women in the Bible that even though, as we read their lives and study of their example, even though they lived in obedience to God, there was not always a good outcome, physically speaking. Some heroes of the Bible suffered tragic ends. Again, God is interested in the spiritual outcome, not the physical outcome. There's a big difference. In the sermon today, we're going to look at an example of obedience that resulted in a bad outcome, physically speaking. But yet this example, this person's name, is mentioned in the faith chapter as an example of someone that we should follow. It's also one of the shortest stories about a righteous individual. There's not much written. I mentioned as we began the sermon that from the beginning of time, men and women have suffered for doing good. So that's where we're going to go today, to the beginning of time, to the beginning of the time of mankind. We're going to look at lessons from righteous Abel. If you're looking for a title, that was it. Let's begin today by turning to Genesis. Let's read the short narrative about Abel, and then we're going to examine it a bit closer to hopefully dig out some very helpful lessons for us today. A bit of a disclaimer before I get into this, in order to avoid any copyright issues, I will mention that some of my comments and some of the ideas were taken from a website I found when I was Googling this topic for my research on the subject. I had already decided I was going to speak about Abel, but I thought, well, what are the lessons? What lessons can be found that I'm not thinking about? And so I just did a Google search, and I found something that was very, I thought, insightful and helpful and what I wanted to pass along to you. The website, it has an odd name. The website is called Klang, K-L-A-N-G, churchofchrist.org. The article written by a man named Roger Campbell. Now, that seems odd. I am not endorsing studying Church of Christ websites. Don't get me wrong. That's just happened to be where the article was, and it had some very good points in it that I wanted to share, and I didn't want someone to get after me for any copyright issues. So, that being said, I think we've taken care of that. Let's read Genesis chapter 4 and verse 1, and then we'll go back through this. Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain and said, I have acquired a man from the Lord. Then she bore again, this time his brother Abel. Abel was a keeper of sheep. Cain was a tiller of the ground. And in the process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought an offering of the fruit of the ground to the Lord. Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat. And the Lord respected Abel and his offering, but he did not respect Cain and his offering. And Cain was very angry. His countenance fell. And the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry? Why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, won't you be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin lies at the door. And its desire is for you, but you should rule over it. Now Cain talked with Abel his brother. And it came to pass when they were in the field that Cain rose up against Abel his brother and killed him. And then the Lord said to Cain, where's Abel your brother? And he said, how do I know? Or I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper? And he said, what have you done? The voice of your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. So now you are cursed from the earth, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you till the ground, it shall no longer yield its strength to you. A fugitive and a vagabond you shall be on the earth. Certainly a very tragic story. It really, to us, just doesn't seem logical that the very first two people created by God on this earth, Adam and Eve, would have this happen to them. Think of them as our first parents, and their children were involved in this. Their very first child, the very first child ever born, we believe, Cain, became a murderer. And tragically, it appears, their next son was his victim. You talk about heartache. Imagine the heartache and the pain of Adam and Eve, what they've has happened to them. Cain becomes, it says, a fugitive and a vagabond, and Abel is dead. We're not told much about their reaction, what happened to them. Perhaps there, at this time, would have now been other brothers and sisters around that were not told about. We know that they were born at some time. The only clue that we get as to the timing of the murder is from verse 3 in the account, and it simply says, in the process of time, it came to pass. Now, that's about as vague as you can get. I found something about this on Life, Hope, and Truth I thought I would share with you. It says, the Bible gives us only an abbreviated account of the lives of Adam's dominant children. That is Cain, Abel, and then Seth, because of their profound effect on history. Cain was Adam and Eve's firstborn, Abel was murdered, and Seth was to be, quote, instead of Abel, God-fearing and righteous like him. In that long time between the births of Cain and Abel and the birth of Seth, 130 years after Adam's creation, it is reasonable to assume that Adam and Eve had many additional children. As those children matured and married, they undoubtedly had children themselves. In that period of more than a century, it's likely that there were literally generations that rose from Adam and Eve's children and in turn from their children. Genesis 5 and verse 4 speaks of Adam having, quote, sons and daughters. So clearly there were more children, of which the Bible tells us nothing. End of the quote. So if that's the case, there was likely a great deal of grief, not only with Adam and Eve, but among all these brothers and sisters about what Cain had done to Abel. If not having witnessed it, they certainly knew about it, were told about it. So as we look at this story of Abel, what are some observations we can make? Sometimes we have to read between the lines. Let's begin with his family. Sometimes siblings, brothers and sisters, raised in the same home, under the same circumstances, turn out drastically different in the spiritual realm. It's puzzling, but that happens. Cain, his works were evil. Abel's, obviously, we're told, were righteous. Yet they had the same parents, same mother and father. They went different directions in their spiritual lives. There's even some speculation that Cain and Abel may have been twins. Regardless, they likely were fairly close in age. And with that being the case, having the same heredity and the same environment. If you remember from biology class in high school, you know, talking about heredity and environment, which has the most impact on you. Well, they had the same heredity and environment, and yet turned out so different. You would have thought they would have been virtually identical young men. Clearly, that was not the case. So I think we can learn something from even that today. We as parents have an obligation to raise our children in the ways of God. To do this, parents must both teach the children the truth verbally, but live the truth as examples for their children to follow. Again, as we just heard in the sermonette. After such training, those children are on their own when they grow into adulthood. When they reach the age accountability, whether that's 18 or 21, they have to make their own decisions, what they're going to do with their lives. As parents, we need to do the best we can, rearing our children, raising our children properly. But if one of them or more of them later decide, well, I don't want to live this way, and they stray away from the truth, parents shouldn't constantly be blaming and punishing themselves for the foolish mistakes of children. They will make their mistakes. Now, we see that both Cain and Abel knew about God. Clearly, they did. Likely, regular communication from God was something that they were used to. Imagine their environment, what they had available to them. So if that was the case, why didn't Cain have a proper fear of the Lord? Hadn't he heard of God, knew God, a close relationship with God? Could it be Cain took the regular presence of God in his life for granted? I've always had this. It's nothing new to me. That's all he'd ever known. So perhaps that's a lesson for those who have grown up in the church, never knowing anything else except the presence of God in your home, in your household. We're taught as young children to love and respect our parents. Cain and Abel were taught that. As we grow older, this love and respect should also be given to God, our Father. So it would seem, yes, Abel obeyed and respected his parents, obeyed and respected God as well. Abel listened to both. He listened to his physical parents. He listened to God. Now let's turn to the story of the offerings. Verse 3. As I said, it states, "And in the process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought an offering of the fruit of the ground to the Lord. Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat. And the Lord respected Abel and his offering, but he did not respect Cain and his offering." Now why? What's going on here? The first hint that we have of the possible problem between Cain and Abel's offering is the fact we are told here specifically that Abel presented the firstborn of his flock. How did he know? Did he pay that close attention to the animals? There were a lot of animals around. Well, this indicates that Abel gave specific thought and care to his offering by marking or identifying which of these animals are the firstborn of the flocks. I don't think they had branding irons at the time. But he knew which were the firstborn of his flocks, and he knew that they were to be dedicated to God as holy. He kept track of his flocks. Again, dedicating the firstborn to God is holy. As holy is something we know God expected later in the offerings. It was established later. Well, likely God had already made that known to Abel and to Cain. He would have been taught as well. Remember, as we read about the sacrificial system of the Old Testament, to worship God, you were to bring a sacrifice of blood. A sacrifice that would point to a future Redeemer who was come into the world many, many years later at that time, who it was said would crush the serpent's head. Remember that? That's a reference back to Genesis 3 and verse 15. The sacrifice of Jesus Christ, crushing the work of Satan the devil. Now, there was a lot of symbolism in all this. Certainly, the sacrificial system had a lot of symbolism. You see, you didn't come to God by bringing the works of your own hands as if somehow you could earn your way, purchase your way into salvation. You couldn't then, you cannot now. There was also a great deal of symbolism in Abel's better offering. Why was it better? Again, he evidently knew it was important to offer the life of an animal by its shed blood, in particular, the firstborn of animal. The symbolism was to show that without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sin. Apparently, God wanted that known from the very beginning of the time of mankind. Without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sin. There was sin from the time of Adam and Eve as well. So God's law was in effect. Abel made his offering by faith, it says, perhaps not really understanding the significance that this offering was pointing to, the future sacrifice of the Son of God. Again, they were told they did it by faith, not understanding. Sometimes we have to do things by faith, not understanding. They will understand, certainly people that offered sacrificial sacrifices throughout the times of the Old Testament, at their resurrection, when they understand the plan of salvation and Christ's sacrifice, they will understand the significance of the shed blood of an animal, of the sacrifice. But God, the point is, God had instructed Abel about how to worship him, how to make the sacrifice, how it should be the sacrifice of the firstborn. That's something the entire family should have known, including Cain. God wasn't unclear. God wasn't vague. God wasn't mysterious in communicating to this family about how he was to be worshipped, about what type of sacrifices and what the sacrifices were to be like. God instructed them. God has instructed us as well. We as his children are to worship him today, as he says, in spirit and in truth. And then such worship is pleasing in his sight. That's a reference to John 4, verse 23. We worship him in spirit and in truth. We cannot decide for ourselves how to worship God. You couldn't back then either. The Bible record of Abel's worship shows that there is such a thing as acceptable worship. That is something that is acceptable or pleasing to God. On the other hand, there clearly then is unacceptable worship, as demonstrated by the offering of Cain. God didn't accept that. There was something not right. You see, God not only appoints, as the Sabbath, a day of worship, he has appointed and assigned a way of worship. We can't just worship any old way we want to. We had a sermon about that not too long ago. Can't we just do what we think is right and God will have to just accept that? No. In order for our worship to be acceptable, it must be pleasing to God, not just whatever we think is pleasing to us. It has to be pleasing to God. And God has revealed to us, as God revealed to Cain and Abel, God has revealed through us in His written word now the way that He wants us today in the New Testament church, how we worship God. God doesn't leave it vague or unclear. Even today, there may be, as I said, some things which we don't really understand why. But we're commanded to do it, and we do it. We obey. Notice also that with the offering that Cain brought forward, had another aspect as to why it was unacceptable. Cain's offering consisted of fruit or vegetables. Now, on the surface, it would seem, well, that's fine. People bring fruit and vegetables here as an offering, and we appreciate that. We accept it. Say thank you. Well, what was wrong with fruit and vegetables? That's what Cain did. Well, the fruit of the ground offered to God was actually considered an insult to God. Why? To offer the fruit of the ground to God be considered an insult? I wonder why. How about considering Genesis 3:17? Actually, the ground had been cursed. You're going to offer a sacrifice to God from that? Verse 17, then to Adam, he said, "Because you have heeded the voice of your wife and have eaten from the fruit, or eaten from the tree of which I commanded you, saying, 'You shall not eat of it,' then cursed is the ground. Cursed is the ground for your sake. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you." So this fruit offering expresses something. It expresses the emptiness. It expresses the inadequacy of Cain's faith compared to the living, dynamic, and believing faith of Abel to offer the firstborn of the sheep. By offering vegetables or fruit, Cain symbolically was denying that he was a sinner. No need for shed blood for me. He symbolized rejecting redemption by shed blood, simply thinking, I can approach God, I can come to God in my way, the way that I see fit to worship Him. Cain and the attitude behind his offering was symbolic of the natural way of man that he was following. What seems right to me? And what became man's way, mankind's way, doing the things that I think are right. Yes, obviously, Cain believed in God. He heard that voice, you know, the one that would become Jesus Christ. How much he saw, I don't know exactly. It doesn't really say that much, but there was no doubt he believed in God. Believed in, let's say, a religion, but only on his terms, his own terms, the way I want to do it. On the other hand, we see Abel's offering consisting of the firstborn of his flock, something very important to him. Abel and his offering were accepted, but it was not by the work of his own hands, but instead by bringing the right kind of a sacrifice that would cover sin, an animal sacrifice whose neck had been slit, whose blood had been spilled. Abel also demonstrated the right attitude in the giving of his offering. Why is that? How do I mean that? Well, consider. How long have you been a shepherd? There's not too many occupations to choose from. But it was very important to him. His animals were very important. It was not easy for Abel to give up such a fine animal that could obviously improve your production. The nature of Abel's good sacrifice illustrated something. A willingness to give. It also illustrated the genuineness of his faith. It showed that his heart was right. I want to please God. I desire to please God. I want to obey the voice of my father. Now, he obeyed the command that he had learned from his father, Adam, of course, as a young child. I'm sure he was taught, you know, as a youngster, a teenager, about sacrificing, about what to do. He also learned, of course, I believe, directly from God. The command simply was to sacrifice to God. He had been instructed about the way. Again, God doesn't leave something important unclear. He had been instructed about the way to sacrifice. Sure, Cain primarily worked to raise fruits and vegetables, and there's nothing wrong with being a vegetable farmer. That's a worthy and a noble profession. That's great. It was his offering that was not great. There was a problem with that. I think Cain knew the expectation of the offerings. He knew what he should be bringing. But we could say, well, Cain didn't raise animals. Well, couldn't Cain easily have traded the work of the ground, the vegetables, the fruits, for an animal from Abel? I'll give you, you know, a bushel of corn or whatever, you know, for a young lamb. But Cain chose not to do that. Hebrews 11, we have another clue about what's going on. In the faith chapter, Hebrews 11 and verse 4. It says, by faith, again, that we quoted that earlier, by faith Abel offered to God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, through which he obtained witness that he was righteous, God testifying of his gifts. And through it, he, being dead, still speaks. That's a profound statement, what we just read there. It's amazing to read that it says, God is testifying to us today about Abel's gift. Did you see that? God testifying of his gifts. God's talking to us today about Abel's gift. That should show us how important this offering, this sacrifice, really was. It wasn't something just to be glossed over and forgotten about. Oh, that's an interesting story. I don't understand it. Let's move on. It was set there as an example for us today. That's one of the reasons we're covering this subject in the sermon. Abel's sacrifice is said to still be speaking to us today. Abel's been dead a long time. He's still speaking to us today. So that means we need to understand his sacrifice. We need to understand why it was accepted and Cain's was not. There is a difference. It's important for us to recognize it and to know. In Hebrews 12 and verse 24, it likens Jesus Christ's ultimate sacrifice of his life to Abel's, in that both gave their lives for doing the right thing. Many would do that. Many would, through the years, give their lives for doing the right things. In other words, they were totally innocent. Abel was innocent. Jesus Christ was innocent. Completely innocent in that way. Of course, always free from sin. But Jesus Christ was slaughtered like an innocent lamb. Abel had offered an innocent lamb. Notice the comparison. We're in Hebrews 12, verse 24. To Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant, and to the blood of sprinkling that speaks better things than that of Abel. Abel spoke a good thing. Again, this is like a comparison of the physical to the spiritual. Abel was willing to really sacrifice, to give unselfishly of himself in total obedience and in worship toward God. That was the essence of the sacrificial system of the old covenant. Again, not really completely understanding, but obeying to the detail, to the letter. They were paying attention to obeying God in the details of the offering. It wasn't just any way. There had to be a specific way. They had to follow specific directions that were revealed to them, was given to them. Again, these sacrifices, these offerings, were to be a type of what it would mean to give spiritual sacrifices and spiritual offerings today. Chapter 9 of Hebrews. Back a few pages. Hebrews 9 and verse 22. According to the law, almost all things are purified with blood. Without shedding of blood, there is no remission, no forgiveness. So we can see This is from the beginning of time. The shedding of blood is important. Therefore, verse 23, it was necessary that the copies of the things in the heavens be purified with these, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. For Christ has not entered the holy places made with hands, which are copies of the true, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us. Now, I think we all understand the importance of Christ's penalty, or Christ's sacrifice to pay the penalty of sin for us. We accept that sacrifice. We now offer spiritual sacrifices that are very important. We do it in detail in the way that we live, in the way we conduct ourselves, in our thoughts, in our emotions, our attitude, our character. 1 Peter 2 and verse 5. Again, these are scriptures that speak to our spiritual sacrifices, to the detail, to the importance, to looking out after the way that we offer spiritual sacrifices, better sacrifices. Jesus Christ made possible better sacrifices, not physical ones, not the shedding of the blood of an animal. Better sacrifices. 1 Peter 2:5. You also, as living stones, are being built up a spiritual house, a holy priesthood, to do something special, to offer something special. What? To offer up spiritual sacrifices that are acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. Can there be spiritual sacrifices that are unacceptable to God if we pay no attention to them? If we offer them in the way we think, if we give no attention to the detail? Romans 12, verse 1. In speaking of the way we are to live our lives as a sacrifice, I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice. How do we present ourselves? How do we come before God? How do we come before God today? We come into this room, we're approaching the throne of God, worshiping before God. We dress up and we respect Him that way. A living sacrifice. Present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. So, as Abel did with his sacrifice, giving it specific thought and attention to the detail, do we give specific thought and care to our living spiritual sacrifice to God? Do we think about it? Are we really thinking of the ways that we can give the very best of ourselves that we have to offer, the best that we have to offer to God? Or do we say, well, it doesn't really matter, just whatever? You see, Cain's attitude about his offering was that this is good enough. I presented an offering, what more do you want? That's all that was asked of me to do. I was told, present an offering, I've got my offering, it's fruits and vegetables, there, take it. Now that should remind us of something. An attitude like that. I've done what I was asked to do. Luke 17, verse 9. I think we'll recognize this. Luke 17, verse 9. Does he thank that servant because he did the things that were commanded him? You know, the servant and slave relationship, you know. Well, the servant comes and says, well, the slave says, I've done what you asked me to do, master. Think not, he says. So likewise you, when you have done all those things which you are commanded, say we're unprofitable servants. We've done only what was our duty to do. You see, like Abel, we have to go beyond our reasonable service of our duty. We give our sacrifices time and attention to detail and thought and prayer as we present our offerings to God, our living sacrifices to God. It seems sad now for us to think of Abel, that he died at a relatively young age. I don't know what age he was, but for living at that time, when people lived to be, you know, 800-900 years old, he died at a relatively young age for doing the right thing, having the right attitude, really desiring to serve and to worship God, living by the faith that he had. God helped provide that, but he wanted to obey God and wanted to listen to God. But Abel didn't die in vain, did he? Even though his life was cut short. As we read in Hebrews 11, his life still speaks all the way down to us today. Here we are having a sermon about Abel. And we know other righteous men and women have died throughout the ages in service to God also. That should remind us of something that we do when we counsel for baptism. We're told to count the cost of obedience to God. What does it cost? And we, conclusion being, it costs your life. Are we willing to follow and obey God no matter how great the sacrifice may be asked of us to give? Do we trust God even if it costs our very lives? Countless men and women have had to do that down through the ages. We don't know their names, who they are, only some of them. This brings up another characteristic of Abel that perhaps we've overlooked, not thought of. The quality of trust. Is it possible Abel may have people think, well, he was too naive. He was too trusting. He should have known better. Was Abel oblivious to Cain's mounting resentment, his jealousy and anger? Could he not see something going on in his brother? Is that possible? Apparently, some time had passed from the actual time of the offering until Cain attacked Abel. Because, again, the only clue we have is in verse 8. Now Cain talked with Abel his brother, and it came to pass when they were in the field that Cain rose up against his brother and killed him. Well, how much time passed? A few hours? A few years? During that time, whatever it was, between or after the actual offering and Cain's offering being rejected and his countenance fell, had Abel sensed his countenance had fallen? Had Abel sensed his brother's anger? Had Abel sensed that his brother's anger had subsided? It seems he's okay now. Did Abel have any indication that Cain was so upset, that he was still upset? Evidently, the conversation must have come around to the offering when they were together. How long did this conversation go on when it came the time of the murder? All it says is, it came to pass that they were in the field. What was going on in the hours before that? Could Abel have sensed anything? Maybe this resentment and bitterness toward Abel had gone on for quite a while. Maybe Abel should have approached his brother after sensing something was wrong between them. Maybe Abel should have said to Cain, is something wrong, my brother? Are you upset with me? Obviously, Cain should have dealt with his anger. But perhaps Abel really had no indication as to just how angry Cain had become. Did he really consider him dangerous to him? Because after all, Cain was his brother. His older brother. Perhaps older brother. It would have been natural for a younger brother to trust an older brother. He's my brother. He won't hurt me. But had Cain given Abel some reason to mistrust him before? What was it like at the dinner table the night before? What was their relationship like as brothers before this time? 10 years before, or whatever. Had Abel often been mistreated or insulted by his brother multiple times in the past? And it was, well, that's just normal. That's just the way he is. And he learned to deal with that situation in a brotherly kind of way. How many times had Abel had to forgive Cain for the way that he was treated prior to this incident? How many times prior to this had Cain flew off the handle at Abel and said, you dirty little rat, you stinking little brother of mine, you know, whatever. Was that there? Had it not been dealt with? We have a principle in Matthew 18. about forgiveness. Matthew 18 and verse 21. Peter came to him and said, "Lord, how often shall my brother sin against me and I have to forgive him?" How many times had it ever happened? Had Cain come to Abel and said, "I'm sorry, Abel, I'm acting like a jerk here. I'm sorry, will you forgive me?" Had that happened before? Up to seven times shall I forgive him? And Jesus said, "No, I don't say to you seven times, but 70 times seven." So perhaps Abel can teach us something about how to be tolerant, how to be patient with an antagonistic brother or sister who might not be treating us so kindly. Now, nobody should ever take abuse without saying something. But we can be patient. We can try to be understanding as we perhaps try our very best to resolve a bad situation that might be taking place in our family. We should, as the principle tells us, always go to our brother. This certainly includes a physical brother or sister. When we sense there's tension, when we sense there's resentment building here, there's anger building here. At any rate, Abel may have not dealt with it, maybe should have, maybe he had and thought things were getting better. But apparently, Abel was physically overpowered by his brother Cain when he led him out into the field and he attacked him there. How is it that he could be physically overpowered? I kind of doubt if Abel really was expecting anything like this from his brother. Maybe they were angry at each other. Maybe they had fistfights, you know, certain things as brothers will do, get into wrestling matches and that kind of thing. But to die at the hand of my brother. After all, Abel had never seen murder, perhaps hadn't heard of murder, really understood it. So I wonder if it's possible even Cain didn't realize the severity of his actions, the consequences of his actions. If I strike him too hard, he will die. Did he really understand that Abel would die when he attacked him? Well, let's explore that thought just a little bit more from the Bible. Let's go to 1 John chapter 3 for an idea about Cain's attitude, Cain's anger, Cain's hatred. 1 John 3 verse 11. "For this is the message that you heard from the beginning, that we should love one another, not as Cain, who was of the wicked one and murdered his brother." And why did he murder him? We're going to get an answer here. Why Cain murdered Abel. It says, "Because his works were evil and his brothers were righteous." There's our answer. This passage seems to indicate that Cain had an ongoing pattern of evil works, actually influenced by Satan the devil, who was certainly still on the scene and trying to disrupt and to destroy this first family. Family would become an object of attack for Satan the devil. Satan is still constantly attacking the family unit. We see that so clear today. He started with Cain and Abel. It continues to this day. Now, we've been talking quite a bit recently about the supreme importance of strengthening our families. Because our families should be model families where peace and happiness abounds. Again, I'll refer to the sermonette. That our families are places to be, places you can gather where there's joy and peace and learning of God's way. Our homes should be safe havens with strong bonds of unity and love. Our homes should be places where jealousy and anger and resentment are not acceptable, not allowed, not tolerated. No jealousy, no anger, no resentment, not in our home. Because we know where that leads. It leads all the way to hatred. And Cain is our first example of where hatred leads. Jesus Christ said in Matthew 5 and verse 21, in the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew 5, verse 21, "You have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not murder. Whoever murders will be in danger of judgment.' But I say to you, whoever is angry with his brother without cause also shall be in danger of the judgment." Anger leads to breaking the commandment to not murder. In certain cases, when disputes or disagreements arise, friends sometimes don't act very friendly. Brothers sometimes don't act very brotherly. Obviously, Cain did not. We forget to look at ourselves and see, might I be the problem? After all, is there something I have done that I just don't see? Do I have a misunderstanding about something? And we so easily will tend to become angry in circumstances. What is it we're angry at? Who are we angry at? Is that anger actually directed toward God or towards the teacher who's teaching God's truth? There's an interesting verse about this subject in Galatians 4, verse 16. I won't give you time to turn to it. I said, Mr. Kelly, you never do. Galatians 4, verse 16. "Have I therefore become your enemy because I tell you the truth?" Your enemy because I'm telling you the truth. What's that old saying? The truth hurts. Especially true when someone else has done the right thing, Abel. You begin to realize you have not, Cain. It's hard to be shown up. It's hard to be embarrassed. In this case, in God's eyes. God knew it. God watched it. Once again, these emotions lead eventually to bitterness and anger and to hatred. Another lesson we can learn is that Abel's death should remind us that God's people often suffer and are persecuted for obedience to God. We've covered this a little bit already. Our way of life is quite different from that of other people. Certainly an understatement right there. As we present ourselves in our communities, our workplaces, or to our relatives, we present ourselves as Sabbath keepers, people who observe those, quote, Jewish holy days, rather than celebrating Christmas, Easter, and so on. And when we abstain from unclean meats, to others we stand out, well, you're different, you're odd, why are you like that? People who are wrong when it comes to religion often become angry when someone points out, you're not doing it the right way, you're making a mistake, when their sins are pointed out. So when we publicly proclaim by our actions and certainly by our message that today, Saturday, the seventh day, is the Sabbath, not Sunday, and that we should observe the holy days, not the pagan holidays, people become angry with us. Who do you think you are? We're perceived as trying to be holier than thou. You self-righteous people, well, we're okay. But we're simply trying to live the truth. Those who don't understand that may think we're trying to present ourselves as better than they are. And that can lead to misperceptions and misunderstandings, which take us down the path to resentment, to jealousy, to bitterness, to resentment, to anger and hatred and so on. So it's clear, Abel's righteous actions irritated Cain. The brother, my little brother, you little do-gooder thing. Because in his heart, you think Cain knew that Abel had done the right thing and he didn't? Instead of realizing his mistake, saying, I'm sorry, you're right, I should have done a better offering. I'm so sorry, will you forgive me? I'll bring it now. Instead of realizing his mistake and changing, he begins to allow jealousy and anger to build to the point of hatred. So from the time of this first family, mankind has demonstrated becoming angry over being told what to do and how to do it. Nobody tells me what to do. It's as if Cain was the father of that attitude. Cain's parents had also made the choice of deciding for themselves how to worship God in their own way. Cain apparently picked up on that, didn't he? He was listening to the serpent as well. And when Abel chose instead to listen to God and to obey Him willingly and according to the principles and the guidelines that God had clearly revealed, that God had made known, Cain resented that. Cain acted on his human nature, his evil, selfish desires, this becoming known as, quote, the way of Cain. Not the way of God, the way of Cain. Notice Jude verse 10. Jude verse 10, but these speak evil of whatever they do not know. And whatever they know naturally, like brute beasts, in these things they corrupt themselves. Woe to them, for they have gone in the way of Cain, and have run greedily in the error of Balaam for profit, and perished in the rebellion of Korah. Greed and rebellion. So through the ages, Cain has become an example of the way of those things, the way of greed, corruption, and rebellion against God. Abel, instead, has become an example of righteousness. And so Abel became the first human being to be martyred for his obedience to God. There would be many more who would follow in his steps. So Abel was living a righteous life. It's clear that Cain was not. In Matthew 23 and verse 35, we have a statement that says this. That was Matthew 23 and verse 35. That on you may come all the righteous blood shed on the earth from the blood of righteous Abel. That's inserted there as a clear statement that Abel was in fact considered righteous by God. This is just not us coming to that conclusion. Cain didn't have it in his heart to please God. He focused instead on the letter of the law. I've got to do just what I have to do in order to get by. His mind seemed to be rather on personal gain. I want to grow. I want to have wealth. Ruling over his family, his growing family. He didn't want to be bothered with receiving instructions and guidance from God. I don't need that. I decide for myself. And he allowed himself to also, as were Adam and Eve, his parents, he allowed himself to be influenced by Satan, even though he should have seen the example of his parents. He should have known better. He should have known what happened to his parents for that decision. And it reinforces that lesson that sometimes the children think they want to experience life for themselves, rather than looking at the example of their parents, listening to them, learning from the instruction from their parents. Adam and Eve could have told Cain and Abel, listen, we made a mistake. Don't do what we did. Experience is not always the best teacher, is it? It's just not. There's something to be said for revealed knowledge. That's an important point of the sermon today. Especially when it comes from loving parents. And it comes from God. Knowledge revealed by God. We have the opportunity to have revealed knowledge. We don't have to make the mistakes to learn lessons. So Cain did not have real faith in God and His promises, even though it should have been very obvious to him. Real faith that pleases God must be evidenced by action on that faith. The way you act, the way you live. Abel expressed that faith by the action of the effort that it took to offer the correct, a right sacrifice. He prepared his offering and he presented his offering to God in the prescribed way, paying close attention to detail. He knew which animal was the firstborn of his flock. His quality offering accurately reflected something. It reflected the quality of his life, the quality of the way of life that he had chosen to live. Again, the New Testament clearly identifies Abel as righteous Abel. What is righteousness? Following God, His commandments. His offering was more excellent, and it was a witness to us. What's a witness? It's outward evidence. We can see, we can learn from this example. It was outward evidence of Abel's inward way of thinking. His righteousness, his commitment, his faith. Yes, Abel gave a physical offering or the sacrifice of an animal. that was not the important part. The animal really means nothing. But it was the heart and the attitude behind it, like David wrote in the Psalms. We'll recognize this from Psalm 51. Psalm 51, verse 16. For you do not desire sacrifice, or else I would give it. Speaking of God, says, you don't delight in burnt offerings. God's not all about slaughtering animals. It's the heart behind it, the intent. Verse 17, the sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and a contrite heart. These, O God, you will not despise. And God noticed that attitude in Abel. He notices it in us as well. Our righteous actions will not go unnoticed or unrewarded by God. As Revelation 22, verse 12 brings out, behold, I am coming quickly. My reward is with me to give to every man according to what he does with his faith, his actions, his good works. Let's carefully consider the lessons here. What can we learn from the difference between the lives and attitudes of Cain and Abel? I think another significant lesson is that we cannot rely just on the outward appearance of religious worship to please God. Because, as I stated earlier, as we first read this story, perhaps as a young child, it's hard to discern that there was anything wrong with Cain's offering in the first place. We're told he brought an offering of the fruit of the ground. Fair enough. He was a farmer. Wasn't he simply presenting a portion of his fruit harvest as an offering? So what's wrong with that? It seems so innocent. Once again, we see human reasoning can enter the picture. Cain may indeed have thought that he was doing good enough by his own standards, by his own personal observation. This is the way I look at it, so it must be right. However, as we have already mentioned, Cain knew or should have known that God required the shedding of blood in a proper offering and a sacrifice. Again, it's not specifically mentioned, but I think we can be assured that God had fully explained the animal sacrifice and offering system to this first family. How else would Abel have known? Cain apparently was trying to compromise, again doing what he thought was right, what was just good enough for God. And Cain tried to hide something. He was hiding his unrighteous life through an offering. Oh yes, I'm making an offering, see? But it was inferior. It was inadequate. It wasn't good enough. God, you see, looks at the heart, not at the outward appearance. For us today, it can be the same situation. None of us really know the heart of someone else. That's why we're told not to judge others inappropriately. We don't know the intent of the heart, but God does, as 1 Chronicles 28, verse 9, which I'll read quickly for you. 1 Chronicles 28, verse 9, David's instructions to Solomon about this is given here. As for you, my son Solomon, know the God of your father. Serve him with a loyal heart and a willing mind. That was important in the Old Testament at the time of David and Solomon. It was important at the time of Cain and Abel. For the Lord searches all hearts, and he understands all the intent of the thoughts. If you seek him, he will be found by you. But if you forsake him, he will cast you off forever. So God will know if we're insincere, if we're half-hearted in our worship of him. He will know if we have our heart in what we are doing, in the work of God that we are participating in or not. He will know if we love him. He will know if we serve him with our whole heart. As the book of Deuteronomy tells us several times, you go back and look at this in the book of Deuteronomy, how many times it tells us to worship God with all of our heart and our strength and our being. Deuteronomy 10, verse 12, I'll read this one. Deuteronomy 10:12, and now Israel, what does the Lord your God require of you but to fear the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, to love him, to serve the Lord with all your heart and with all your soul. Again, we cannot be hypocritical in our worship of God. We cannot pretend to be righteous outwardly while in our heart we're holding back. In our heart we're giving our sacrifices grudgingly, as it says. Remember, as we read on holiday offering days in 2 Corinthians 9:7, let each one give as he purposes in his heart, not grudgingly or of necessity, for God loves a cheerful giver. So you see, Abel had purposed in his heart to give the best that he could to God. Cain simply did not. Jesus Christ corrected the Pharisees for a similar issue. The Pharisees, oh yes, they appeared extremely righteous externally. To look at them, whoa, how righteous. They appeared to be doing everything literally by the book. But inwardly, not a very good description of them. They were unrighteous and living lives totally unacceptable to God, as we read in Matthew 23. He brings that out. You see, our love for God and His way of life, our love for His righteousness, must go down to the very core of our being, from our heart. That doesn't mean God's not concerned about our outward appearances and our actions, yes. It's because our outward actions reflect, as a man speaks, so he is. It's our outward actions reflect our inward character, as we are becoming doers of the word. We don't just hear, we act on our faith, reflected in our good works. So we bring this to a conclusion and summarize the point. Why was Abel to be called righteous? I had to get that in there once. Why was Abel to be called righteous? We know that he knew enough to be in the first resurrection, right? Obviously, he will be in the kingdom of God. He's listed in Hebrews 11, the faith chapter, and verse 13 says, these all, this is including, they've already mentioned Abel, these all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, assured of them, embraced them, confessed they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. What's our last takeaway from this? What did Abel know? What was necessary for Abel to be in the first resurrection? From the story of Abel today, we see that he knew a couple of points or a few points. Abel knew obedience to God, the essence of the Ten Commandments, and righteousness. He knew the keeping of the law of God. Abel knew obedience and respect to his parents, certainly including God. I said that, obedience to God, obedience and respect to his parents. Number three, he acted upon revealed knowledge from God. Things were revealed to him by God that he took on faith. This must be right. God told me this. Next, he was willing to do exactly what was commanded of him to do without compromise. No, let me do it my way. I think my way is good enough. No, he did exactly what was commanded of him without compromise. Next, Abel knew how to be a shepherd. Interesting to consider, some of God's greatest servants had a background as a shepherd. Moses, David. Jesus Christ himself uses shepherding to describe his role as a leader and caregiver of God's people. Shepherd the flock. And lastly, what Abel knew, he expressed humility toward his brother, his family, and to his God. It was an example of humility. Now, having said what Abel knew and will be in the first resurrection, what was not needed for salvation? Today, people believe there are new things that have come along that we must know this secret knowledge, this important knowledge, in order to be in God's kingdom. And if you don't, you won't be there. What did Abel not know anything about? Well, today, in our time, we think of there are certain divisive issues of today, such as calendar issues and sacred names and the timing of the marriage supper, for just a few. Abel. Yeah. prophecy issues and speculation about end time events in the place of safety. Talk about the place of safety to Abel. He'd say, well, that's in the garden over here. Right now. Abel did not know anything about one man rule in the church or other forms of church government. He didn't know anything about voting and politics. Just a few things I kind of come up with. There's probably so many more. There's a phrase that's sometimes used in the Church of God community. We'll say, well, that's a non-salvational issue, right? In other words, there are some things that are very concerning to people, yet have no bearing whatsoever on the process of salvation. They become what the Bible calls a striving after wind. They become issues that cause division rather than unity. So as we look at the story of Abel and his sacrifice, we see God is most concerned about matters of the heart. As Micah 6:8 reminds us, we are to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with our God. That seems to define what Abel was able to do. It should define what we do. Our heart should be a heart of willing service and sacrifice in humble obedience to God. Yes, physically speaking, Abel suffered death at the hands of his brother, something he would have never expected. I thought I would be blessed. He was listening to God, respecting his instructions, trying his best to be obedient to it. So God should bless me, right? No, he was martyred. But in his next instant of conscious thought, he will rise, hopefully alongside all of us, at the soon coming return of Jesus Christ. And along with us, Abel will be able to receive the promises of God that he saw afar off from the very beginning of time.